You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and in an episode recorded at The Place Hotels on York Place in Edinburgh, and I want to give a quick mention to them because not only are they a lovely hotel, they very kindly allowed me to record some episodes there. I've got episodes coming up with Carmen Lynch and Chris Gethard, and one or two more besides that the people at The Place Hotel on York Place in Edinburgh were very kind enough to allow me a bit of space to record there. So thanks for them. I think they're slightly beyond my budget. I mean, you might get a deal on late rooms, but certainly if you're one of my more high-rolling listeners, then you should check that place out. When I went there to record the Bill Burr episode, I got a bloody suite. It was amazing. He didn't bat an eyelid, of course. Bill, as I'm sure, used to highfalutin places like that. So this one recorded at the Place Hotel. So thank you very much to them. This is the fabulous Loyisu Gola, a South African comedian. He has his own show. We'll be finding out why he has his own show, don't we all? He's got his own TV show, Late Night News in South Africa. He's been Emmy nominated in the International Emmys, and we're about to find out why. This is Loyisu Gola. So tell me how the run is going. How many times have you been to Edinburgh?
I've been to Edinburgh 4 times. I came the first time, I don't remember the year, but I came just to check it out and do some spots.
Okay.
Then I came back the next year, did an ensemble show. Well, I'd say ensemble. It was a two-man show.
Who was the other comic with you?
Dave Levingston. He's from South Africa.
Okay.
And then I came 3 years ago to do a one-hour show. And then I'm back to do another hour show. But the thing is, I think the thing about this festival, every time you come here, you learn something new. And even people who've been doing it like for 20 years, they'll tell you something and you're like, oh no, I see it. There's always a new thing that's popping up, right? There's always like a, cause I don't think the first, how long has Free Fringe been around?
Maybe 10 years.
Right. I think I started coming here about 6-7 years ago. And so Free Fringe was still a smallish thing. It's bigger now, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And also just the idea of how the festival functions. As even like the last three years ago, I had posters everywhere, pretty much, which cost a lot.
Yeah.
And it's pointless to have posters if no one at the festival really know you.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, well, I've got my feelings about that, but you tell me what you mean. Explain what
I mean,
you mean
like, because when people look at a poster, they kind of like know the person, or the people in posters are known people already, per se, I would say. So, you know, I think it's way pointless to... this is the thing. The festival is not a science. There could be someone next year who comes and turns everything around by tweaking something that everyone thought they had ticked in the box, right? Right?
Yeah, man. I've been coming here for a long time, and I because of just the way my mind works, I always want to try and identify the system and then try and game the system and do, you know what I mean? Learn how you do it. And you're absolutely right. And the more I come here, the more I think to myself, oh yeah, I used to think it was like that. And then someone just does the opposite and you go, oh right. Like I personally feel about posters. Posters aren't for punters. They're not to get audience members into your show. That's not what they do. Posters are a way of telling the comedy industry that you're doing really well because everyone knows how much posters cost.
Right.
So if you put big, big posters there, when I see a huge poster of someone's face, I think they're being successful because they have enough financial backing to put big posters everywhere. That's a way of telling
the industry people. Now, whether I don't think that consciously. I have analysed the way I naturally feel when I see that.
Right, okay.
Do you know what I mean? It's the same as the quality of someone's poster, the quality of the photograph.
Right.
If it's lit really well, you're like, whoa, they spent 600 quid on a photographer. You don't notice you're thinking that.
Right.
But it goes in already. You're like, oh, this guy. Like your press shot for this show, Dude, Where's My Lion?
Yes.
That's an expensive looking photo, right?
It was expensive.
Yeah. So that's a really good, whenever I see that picture, I think this guy is he's a professional guy.
I get what you're saying. No, I don't think for me it's subconscious. I think for me it's quite like direct. I go, that's a piece of shit. Piece of photography or whatever the case, or the artwork is a piece of shit. And but sometimes it doesn't correlate with the quality. It might translate in my brain as he probably doesn't care about that stuff.
Oh, when you see someone with a low quality poster.
Yeah, picture, right? Because sometimes I've seen people with really good pictures and they are shit.
Yeah.
And right,
so I mean, anyone who's got 500 quid can get a decent photograph.
Right. So then I'm aware of the quality of the picture and, oh, this is, and sometimes, cause I know a lot of acts in New York who like really funny guys. And when they promote their specials, they just put a random picture of themselves and they're like, and that it's not an indicator of how good they're doing or anything. Of
yes.
That
I think there's almost, when you're successful enough,
yeah,
you can do whatever you want.
Right.
Because everyone already, the brand is already established.
Right.
So with your image this year, and when you come to the festival here or when you go to other comedy festivals or wherever, what decisions are you making? Just while we're talking about posters, what are you trying to tell us with your imagery?
It's funny. When I did that photo shoot, I did the photo shoot and I took six posters. I mean, six pictures. We chose six pictures and we were choosing from 18 pictures, me and this photographer. And I was like, okay, these pictures will probably last me another year and a bit. And whatever. So when I decided to come to the festival, I thought I was going to do another shoot and I didn't have the time. I just totally missed it. And I was like, oh, you need to hand it. And so I was choosing from old pictures, but I really wanted to do new pictures. So I didn't really get time to think about that stuff. I didn't really get the time to, but I've always the thing is, even back home, sometimes some people say when they want to do some press and be like, we'll take the pictures while we're doing. And I always refuse because I'm just like, no, just, I'll send you properly.
Yeah, this image
sounds
control.
Pretentious.
Yeah, okay.
But just take these pictures just take these ones. And some of them will go to Google and find. And I'm just like, no, here's some goddamn pictures. You know, because if you take it slightly seriously, like just the stand up of it and control the way people kind of see you. And especially for me, because no one knows me in this country. And so if I am building a persona in a different territory, I have to kind of control that and narrate that. Right. Cause back home now, they can put any picture. Because I've established myself a particular way. So yes. Whatever picture they put, they're like, that guy from that thing.
Sure.
Right? But here you got to go, oh no, it's consistently has to be that.
This is, well, let's talk about this. So for the main base of the listenership of this show is in the UK.
Right.
So I always think this is a sort of fascinating dynamic when I'm talking to someone who obviously, like you're a pretty big deal, right? In South Africa.
Yeah,
Emmy nominated.
Yeah, yeah.
Created your own TV show.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell us, just for those who don't know you, just give us, and you can be as grandiose as you like. I mean, just tell us who you are.
A couple of years ago, my career was taking off back home. And what was happening is I found myself doing a lot of TV stuff, but I didn't like it. So I decided, let me go to all these channels who want to have me on TV and pitch to them what I would like to do as opposed to. And so I got together a group of friends and said, let's make the show. It was a political satirical show. I've always wanted to do political satire. And I remember the first time I ever saw political satire was a show by Bill Murr called Politically Incorrect. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I saw it, I think, online somewhere. And this is a long time ago. This is like when the internet, it's not as accessible. I think it was like 98 or something. Then I saw him on Oprah talking about this show of his. And then I read a while after that he was canned off TV because of some shit that he said. And I'd always wanted to do a show like that, because me and my friends, when we were really young, we used to have these political conversations. And we had, there was nothing on TV like that. And I always wanted, all these conversations are so interesting. I would like to put this on TV. And I pitched a show. We called it Late Night News. I don't even know why we called it Late Night News, because I guess back home, late night television is like 10 o'clock. We had 6 years of it. Ran for 6 years. We shot 2 seasons a year. And we got 2 Emmy nominations. We've just submitted now for another international Emmy. And hopefully, they usually announce it like in October. And hopefully we'll get another nomination, fingers crossed.
And what's the... Well, I've never done comedy in South Africa. I've been there once, but not as a comic. What's the comedy landscape in South Africa? That is an enormous question, I know. But if you could kind of sketch out for those of us who aren't aware of it, like how much kind of comedy is there on TV? How much political satire is there?
I think there's more comedians than audience.
Okay.
Right.
Does that mean there's no audience, or means there's shitloads of comedians?
There's audience, but what I mean is, culturally, right, the society of South Africa doesn't consume comedy the way like America and Britain consumes comedy. And this is what I mean. They don't consume comedy like as a Wednesday night kind of thing. Right? So people, it's usually a big event, right? It's like the Olympics per se.
Okay.
Right? So the club scene is not big, but people can sell out like a 2,000 seater. Do you understand what I mean?
I think so, yeah.
Because people still see comedy as a big event. So when it's usually like people dress up and they look really nice and they go watch comedy.
Okay.
Right? It's like going, it's almost like going to the theater per se. Like, we're going to go watch the ballet. So they see comedy that way. Whereas British people and American people see comedy as a, let's go check it out on a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And a Tuesday
night. It's part of life.
It's part of life. It's not like almost a separate thing. It's not like an event per se. And so this is pure, this is not fact. This is what I've noticed.
Yeah, sure,
right?
Of course.
And so I don't want your timeline on Twitter being bombarded with people. That's bullshit. And so that's my understanding of it. So the landscape, there's a lot of really talented comedians, like really talented. But the thing about South Africa, it's culturally specific. Right, in the sense that we have 11 languages in amongst a population of 50 million. And that breaks the country up into tiny little sections. And so what sometimes kills in one part of the country doesn't. So you have guys who really are doing well in certain parts of the country and in certain language and territories, but then they're not necessarily doing well. And it's such a weird thing to be happening in such a small country, right? But I think for the large part though, there's a lot of really talented guys. And I'm excited for it, because I think in the next 4 or 5 years, there's going to be a lot of acts at this festival and around the world just doing stand-up and people being fascinated by it. And the cool thing about South African acts, I think, is the fact that we totally have an outside perspective into America and Britain. I say America and Britain because these are the two biggest comedy spaces to operate in.
Okay.
Right. So I think in the next 4 or 5 years, it's going to be insane. And we have this perspective of, we understand both cultures. We actually do. We understand Britain because the British colonized. We understand America because we watch American TV, but we're still African in the sense that we live there and we speak the language and we're in touch with what's happening in South Africa and Africa.
Okay.
And so when we come here, our perspective is so brand new to everyone that it just seems like this. Just think, I feel like I've just come from space.
Okay. Yeah, because when an English person, when an English or British comic interprets America, they're interpreting it as an English person.
Yeah.
Whereas you get to look at both from the outside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, like, my show is totally like, even the idea of tipping, right? The British people don't really, you don't have a big tipping culture.
No.
America has a massive, you tip for everything, which is like weird for me because tipping, you tip everywhere in America. Like like someone grabs your luggage, someone code check, everywhere you're tipping, right? At some point that cancels begging then.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I was thinking that. I was like, well, do something. Like tap dance.
Yeah, okay. Because everyone's prepared to pay you small amounts of money for any tiny
service.
Any
tiny thing you do.
Okay.
That kind of negates begging. I don't know. I just thought of that. I was like, okay. But I do find that also, every time I go to America and hang out with comics there and I hang out with British comics, they isolate each other from them, they isolate themselves from each other.
Do you mean between America and Britain?
Yeah. And I'm like, you guys have so much more in common. Like there's so much, cause I play both territories. Right.
So what's your interpretation then of the, I don't mean the stereotypes, but what are the differences between the way British and American people do comedy? Because I mean, obviously, to me, the biggest one is we turn over an hour a year. They've only just started doing that in the States. You'd normally, America's big enough that you can tour the same show for a long time.
Yeah, but I think Americans are less self-involved with their stand-up.
Okay, that's interesting. What? How do you mean?
I mean, of late, that's unraveling. They go for the joke. They go for the joke. It's like they tell actual jokes. Even if they talk about themselves, they get to the joke. Mm-hmm. British people want to tell you something, right? They want to share something. Whereas Americans are like, nah, I'm trying to tell you a fucking joke and I'm getting to the joke. How was the joke? Whereas British people are like, I'm trying to tell them about and it's a bit more involved. This is what I tend to find. And so when I'm doing this festival, I have to make the jokes and the show about myself.
Ah, so you tailor your material for a British audience.
Well, not necessarily tailor. For instance, like if I go to America, I do something, it'll look observational, right? So I'll say, this is what I've observed. But in Britain, let's say you observe something and you talk about it on stage. Now in America, you can talk about it as an observation.
Okay.
In Britain, you have to bring it closer to yourself.
Okay.
And the British people like you more for talking about yourself. They want to know you a bit more.
Know how you felt about something.
Yeah, so that's what I mean, it's a bit more self-involved, where Americans are like, was that funny or was that not funny? And the audiences are like that. And also American audiences are also open to more subjects. I find British audiences can flake on you when you're talking about race.
Okay.
They really don't want to talk about race. And also because, I think it's because first of all, British people have told themselves there's no racism in the in like especially London people. My perspective is only from interacting with London that there's no racism. So when you talk about race, it really freaks them out because it's not a dialogue that's constantly happening in the country.
Yes,
right. Whereas in America, there's always a race dialogue happening. So when you do it on stage, it's almost like you're picking up from a particular issue and you can even dissect the issue, right? Whereas here you're like, there is racism and
I'm not accusing you personally in the room.
Yes,
yeah.
But I'm just saying it exists and this is what happened. And so I find it hard, like in America, You could how many times have you just heard an actor be like, "You white people are full of shit," and American white people be like, "Yeah, we are. Just tell us more about it." Whereas if you said that here, British people are like, whoa, right? So that's what I find as well.
So this is Loyesu. Really fantastic guy, brilliant comic, loads of great stuff to come. Because I don't know where new editor Daryl is going to drop this little bit of blurb in, I don't know whether we've yet had the bit about peeking mischievously into a pot. It's one of my favourite bits on any episode, so if we have had that, wasn't it great? And if we haven't, oh, you've got that to look forward to. So thanks very much to Loyesu for coming along and recording. Thanks again, as I said, to the Place Hotels, very kind of them. And thanks to you for listening. I hope you're enjoying this at the moment. I'm going to do some... I think I might do this on Facebook Live. So if you fancy getting involved with this, then join the Facebook group, the Comedians Comedian Podcast Facebook group. And as well as getting the opportunity to submit your questions for forthcoming guests, such as Maria Bamford, who, all being well, I'm pre-recording this bit, I will be recording possibly right now as this is released on Monday. I'm very excited to be going around Maria Bamford's place in Los Angeles. But if you are part of the Facebook group, then you can put in your, I will frequently say, hey, I'm interviewing this person, and we're really getting a very good class of suggested questions. So thank you very much to everyone that's contributed. But the more specific thing I'm talking about is that I think I'm going to use Facebook Live and have a bit of an experiment with that, and basically talk to you about how the podcast is going, about whether you're getting what you want from it. It's definitely changed over the almost five years of its life. I feel like it's got better, and maybe this is a terrible idea. Maybe you should never ask people what they think in case you go, no, we want more of this and less of that. But that is exactly what we're going to do. So keep an eye out, join the Facebook group, and keep an eye out on Twitter as well. I think in order to do it on Facebook Live on the Facebook group, I can only do it to people who are members, because it is a private group, to lend it that air of... je ne sais quoi, clear off, that element of fuck off that it has if it's private. So I'll look into that. I've basically not thought this through, but it's an idea I had this morning. So it'd be nice to hear back from you. But don't send me emails. I'm going to do that as one organised live video event in order to minimise admin. So if you have feedback on the show generally, save it for that. You can correspond with me, info@comedianscomedian.com, if you would like to suggest guests for me to interview in future, or you know, talk to me generally. That's absolutely fine. And remember, if you add the PS I'm a cool guy, then it means you're allowing me to respond with one word, which I cannot tell you how much my tiny family thanks you for those. So thank you to everyone, all the cool guys, and everyone that's been corresponding. So we'll get back to Loyesu in just a second. So what was I going to say? Something key. Yes, I'm in LA right now. If the new uploading schedule has worked, and please thank new editor Daryl Smith, who's going to be looking after the editing and uploading of this podcast until he just gives up due to having to sit through hours after hours of my voice talking to him mid-interview and saying things like, oh, God, Daryl, take that bit out. And also having to sort of wrangle logs and all of that stuff. But we've got him for now. So thank you, Daryl, on behalf of all of us. Your help is very much appreciated. So with a bit of luck, he'll be uploading this on Monday, and you'll be listening to it shortly afterwards, as I am still in LA. I'm getting to do all sorts of exciting things there. I'm gonna do a load of podcasts with people. I'm going to appear on some other people's podcasts, all of which I'll tell you about again in future when they're in the can. And I might even, if I pull my finger out, I might try and get another recording done while I'm there, as well as the brilliant Maria Bamford and the wonderful Tim Minchin, all of which should be a lot of fun. It's too late now for me to advertise the live streaming code. I hope you enjoyed it if you live streamed. Possibly you can live stream the event afterwards as well. So try going to lapodfest.com and entering the discount code comedian. That gives me a little something. It lets them know that you're one of my fans. You get a discount. I get a little something, a little sugar in my bowl. And you could try doing that, but do pay attention to the small print just in case it says, hey, don't use this after the event because it only went out live. So there we go. That's all of that, admin. I'll chat to you later after the rest of this episode with Loyesu.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hola.
Coming back to that scale of getting to the joke or sharing something about yourself.
Right.
Where does South African comedy fit on that scale? What are the differences between South African comedy and
well, South African
American
comedy is fine.
And I know we're talking about enormous.
No, but I'm saying that it's not, and I would say it's not entirely defined at the moment in that way. So anything, there's all types of acts. There's not like a particular, I would say at the moment it's particularly observational, but it doesn't have a full-fledged definition. You must remember the country as a whole we only had our democratic elections 1994. That's 22 years ago. Black people were only allowed to vote 22 years ago. So we still, there's baby steps.
Yeah.
In terms of like taking the whole country's humor and putting it in a sentence is a bit premature. I'd say 10 years' time, we might have like a pretty definitive style of humor.
And when you were talking before about the different languages, and so you get guys that smash it in this particular area, does everyone have English as a second language?
Yeah.
So do you need to have English as a second language to be able to work the whole of the country?
Not entirely. You can find your pockets of people everywhere you go, because the country is quite, there's a bit of everyone everywhere. But there's a guy though who's touring the country and he's doing like 5,000 seats a night for a week. Like he's really doing well, you know, and he speaks one of the minority languages, and he's touring like a motherfucker.
Okay.
It's crazy.
Because everywhere he goes, there's enough of those people.
Yeah. And those people
are
a community and they, you know, they support him. And he, you know, Mashabela,
what's his name?
Mashabel.
Okay.
Yeah, and he, man. And I don't know. I mean, I think English helps, but also English is also quite limiting. Remember, if you speak five languages.
Do you? Is that five languages? Is that why you?
Well,
five?
I can speak four languages, and then I can kind of wing two.
Okay.
And I can understand what you're saying, and others, I might not be able to have a very fluent conversation with you.
Okay, sorry, interrupt.
But I think that no, it's all good. But I do think that the in South Africa the language thing is a gift and a curse. A curse because it's quite limiting sometimes if you're performing in one language, like especially English, and you're trying to articulate something to a person who doesn't speak that language, and you have to use that particular language, and in that using that particular language, you might lose a portion of the audience because they don't understand what the fuck you're talking about.
Okay.
A gift because that was a curse. The gift is the reason I'm easily able to adapt between America and Britain is because I adapt between about 9 cultures each single time.
Okay.
I travel from one place to another. Okay. And it's like a 2-hour drive and I'm in a totally different place. Not necessarily too vast of a difference, but a cultural barrier and a language barrier. And I kind of don't know, you know, they speak very different. Like Pretoria, they speak, a lot of the guys, they speak Tswana Afrikaans and they have their own slang. They have their own heroes. It's like, you know what I mean? It's quite particular. So you can't take the exact same. You have to accommodate them a little bit, not too much, but a little bit. And you go to Cape Town and that changes dynamic. You go to KwaZulu-Natal, you change that. That's a totally different dynamic. So you could drag someone who's from, you can make fun of someone who's a joke that kills about someone who's from a different part. When you go to their part of the world, you got to find another person that they're going to laugh at because
yeah,
they
okay.
might like that person that much.
Yeah, sure. Do you work in other languages other than English? Do you work in all of your other languages?
I've done it, but it's not, there are guys who are better than me in that particular language. And that is, but it's so crazy because we're planning a tour in October where we're just going to do a Xhosa tour where we're just going to speak a language. There's five Xhosa comedians.
Wow.
And I mean, there've been Xhosa shows where I've been hosting and maybe headlined and stuff, but I think that it's time, man. It's cool.
That's the first comedy tour in.
No, it won't be the first comedy tour. It,
in that language, I mean. With
no,
all the
no, 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 no. There's guys who do. But you must remember, you think in languages, and so you. It's important to. It's almost very important to think in the language you perform in.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's like currency, right? So what happens when people travel? You travel with your own currency, and you get to that place, and you convert every time.
Okay.
So it seems like so you never enjoy what you buy. Like, oh, it's cost so much, yeah. Right?
Okay.
And so that happens. The same thing happens when you are doing stand up and you're not thinking in that language that you're performing in. So you, let's say you're French, but you perform in English. You're thinking in French. So you're converting every single time. So you never, the joke that you do never reaches its full potential because you just don't think in that language. So even if you have the perfect joke, you will never deliver it the way. It's bizarre, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have any other languages. I'm a shameful Brit like the rest of us.
So for me, the reason I haven't really been discouraged to tour in my own language, I don't think I think in my own language. I think in English because I was taught in an English school. And so I think in English. Every learning I've learned has been in English. So therefore, but I can speak my language fluently. But if I'm thinking of an idea, I'm thinking purely in English.
That's nuts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
yeah, I'm glad you think that's nuts as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is a challenge. So for me to do the jokes in course, I have to write the jokes in course. I can't convert my English jokes.
Okay.
I can't.
You try.
I can, but they're not going to be as good as the stuff that I would think of it in my, because in my language, there's a context, there's nuances, there's a world I can paint. But if I'm just copying and pasting, but in a different language or translating, it just doesn't do it justice. It's funny, but it's not what I want to put out there.
And is that, when you say the context, is that because if you imagine a joke that is I'm trying to think of a joke now as an example, but if you imagine a joke that is about seeing a funny thing happen, mm-hmm. like seeing someone run for a train and miss the train,
right,
is that not, can you not create enough of that context that it would work in a different language? Is there such a thing, do you think, as a universal joke, or does the context always demand?
Well, I mean, it depends how you remember. Like the construction of a joke is also not as simple as just telling the joke. And this is what I mean. I mean, like, if a person is missing the bus and trailing the bus, who's telling the story? Number one, are you telling the story from the person who's missing the bus? Are you telling from the observer?
Where is the observer? Are they on the bus? Are they in the street?
Yeah. So there's so many things to think of before you even utter that joke, right? So. It all depends, like, in terms of translating in language, because I haven't done it enough, I might not have the answer. I might not have the answer for this question you just posed on me, but I do think that if I think the joke in English, if I see this thing and my brain computes it, and also you must remember the language also comes with a culture, right? So if in this language I'm thinking in, there is, a cultural, like, there's certain things if in a Xhosa person will not do or say, or when I in their mind, you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. Yeah, go on.
So I'm trying to articulate this best way possible. So as a Xhosa person, I would imagine this joke being told to another Xhosa person, and then culturally there are things that me and him get.
Yes.
A lot of nuances.
Yes, because you can't imagine telling a Xhosa joke to someone who speaks English.
Right.
Because, yeah, okay, I understand.
So I gotta meet them halfway somehow. So what language, then also there's a culture embedded in it. The same with if you're Portuguese, and you know, there's certain, you know, things that you're like, you know.
I think I know what you mean. Can I push you to give us an example?
I'm trying to think of an example. You must remember, like, there's words. So there's words that describe particular things. Like, for instance, in Xhosa, there's a word for peeking at a pot mischievously, right? So if you know what I mean, like,
oh, looking inside it,
yeah,
okay, to see what's it like. Your mom's cooking something, right? And you're not allowed to know what it is,
and you look inside it. There's okay. a word for that.
What is that word?
Ukungikimbiza.
Okay,
do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you kind of like you're playing peekaboo with the pot.
Yeah,
that's see. And so there's certain situations that have particular words.
I see what you mean.
And so in English, you would have to articulate that in a sentence, where in Xhosa, you can use one word.
Yes.
And so
I crept up upon this girl yes. with the mischievous quality that one might look when peeking in one's mother's pot.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know.
Yeah.
I somethinged her. Yeah. Yes.
And okay. So, and also because culturally, I don't know. I mean, it's not a biggie, but my mom would be upset if she caught me doing that.
Okay.
Where in other cultures, it's not an issue at all.
Yeah. Why would she be upset?
I don't know. It's just like a thing. It's like taking pride of, it's your kitchen, you own it. This is your thing. Don't fuck around. I'll.
That's a really good example. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know. I mean, this is also, I'm thinking of this example as I'm going. So I'm saying all these nuances have to be articulated to make the joke a thing.
Okay. You've done how many hour-long shows? How many specials? Like festival shows?
I've done 3 specials back home.
Okay.
3 hours. Which, the writing of those is quite strange, man.
Go on.
Specials. Because
When you say specials, do you mean for TV or you mean like an hour long show or a long show?
Just an hour show.
Yeah, this is a Ronnie Chang thing. You call everything a special.
I never used to even call it a special until, you know, you start seeing other people and they say special.
Exactly. That's what I mean. I think Ronnie Chang is at the forefront of regarding it. Like, you don't write Edinburgh shows. No one knows what, like, globally, no one knows what an Edinburgh show
right,
is.
Right,
it's
right.
a special.
Right,
and then
special,
it also connotes
it's
success
an hour.
And television.
It's, right. It's an hour. You did an hour.
So the writing of the 3 specials was quite funny, you said.
Yeah, I just did a special back home that I put out, and it's going to go, it's going to play on TV soon, and I put it out on DVD and all that kind of stuff. But I do find that the hardest thing is to put out a special, like an hour worth of material, and then you have like maybe 15 minutes of stuff that kind of works. And then you're on stage and you're like, fuck, I've got so much funny stuff that I've just burnt.
Yes.
That I really cannot use under any circumstance. I cannot use this. I do a lot of the stuff that I put on my specials on the shows that I do here in Edinburgh because the people haven't heard it here. But back home, I just refuse. I just go, I'll work it on stage until it comes right.
Okay.
So I have these ideas and I grind them.
Talk to me about grinding them. What does that mean?
I try to make them work and sometimes there's a lot of ways to make them work. You can link them to another bit that you have. You could try tell it from a different angle. You could try animate all the characters. But I try to make the bit work. And what I learned very early from stand-up was you got to find it funny first. So if you someone said to me, you got to find, if you find it funny, that's enough. Because if you believe the idea is funny, then you can try make it work and it can be funny. But if you write stuff because you think the audience is going to find it funny, then you put yourself on the back foot because now you don't know what to fix because you don't know what they're going to find funny, right? You don't go, oh, you just go, I really think this is funny or ironic. How do I then communicate this idea to these people until they get it? Do I add another character? Do I impose? I don't know. You find various techniques to tell bits. And so when I start writing, what I do is before I release a special, I make sure, first of all, I heard Chris Rock do this. And I said, I have to do this. You have to, he says, he when he drops a special, he has 30 minutes waiting on the other side of other material.
Okay.
So he's already written like another 30. And so that's what I do.
Oh, so when you burn it, I see when you drop it, when you burn it.
Yeah.
You're not burning it. You're not burning yourself back to zero. Ever.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
So like right now, I've got an hour. Now, this is what's happening in my life right now. I've got an hour now that I'm doing in Britain. And then I go back home to get a visa. And then I'm going to New York to shoot a special. My first sort of international release special. So on the 28th of September, I'm shooting a special for Vimeo.
Okay. Hey, great.
But they've never done a comedy special before. So I'm their first comedy special ever.
Okay.
And it's such a bizarre platform. I was like, because they do films and short stuff and quite edgy stuff. And they saw me do some stand-up like, oh, that's some edgy stuff per se. And they were like, okay, cool. We'd like to put you. And I was like, but you don't do stand-up. They're like, just fucking come. And so I'm doing a special in New York on the 28th. Now, I don't think I'm going to do the same show I did in Edinburgh. I think I have to either compile a new show or I don't know. I think I just have to compile a new show.
You don't want to be doing on your first ever Vimeo's first comedy. You don't want there to be anything on it that anyone can see somewhere else.
Not necessarily. I mean, the stuff that's out in South Africa doesn't affect them because it doesn't reach the world.
Okay.
But I do think that the audience in America and the audience in Britain, especially the fringe audience, are two very vast different. And I'm shooting this in Brooklyn. And so in Bushwick, is Bushwick Brooklyn? Anyway, Bushwick, yeah. We're shooting it in Bushwick. And these are two vast audiences. Vastly, vastly, vastly different audiences. And so I have to get to America and in a week figure out a new show for the American audience. Even if it's the same material, it has to be performed very differently.
Yes. Have you got warm-ups over there?
I don't do warm-ups.
Like you're not going to run in the material. You're just going to.
Oh, you mean warm-ups?
Yeah, warm-ups for the show.
Yeah, I think I got two. I got two warm-up.
Like non-recorded
spots.
Kind of ones.
I just work out. But I actually feel more comfortable doing an hour than 10 minutes, which is a crazy thing. Because an hour you can win people over.
Yep.
I think like 40 minutes into your show, sometimes you go, people are usually like, we're down with whatever you have to say. We trust you so much because you've won them over in like 40 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And I think like the 40 minute mark is like the time where you're like, okay, cool, let's do it. Let me take you to all these weird places that I want to go to.
Okay, yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah, because unless you haven't gotten them at all and then you're like, oh, fuck, it's 40 minutes.
Another 20 of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's incredibly important that I do a different show for them, especially for Vimeo as well. It's their first special, and it has to have a little bit of edge. I don't know where I'm gonna find the edge. I'll have to dig deep. I don't know what that even means.
I was gonna ask you what you meant. Because it's Brooklyn. Because it's America, because you need to be more, you need to be doing stuff that's relatable to them in a different kind of way. What do you mean?
I have these ideas. I haven't have them fully fledged yet, like in terms of I have these ideas and these thoughts that I want to shit, but they're quite complicated to turn into stand-up. Mm-hmm. And I was in Paris like three, four weeks ago, and I did this bit for the first time, and it really worked. And it was like, I wish I could tell you the bit, but I'm still working on it, and I just want to burn it. But it talks about colonialism. But here's the thing. I spoke about me and a friend of mine were discussing this. We're talking about Black history. Now, Black history is a weird thing that gets discussed, right? Because Black history is the only history that only gets discussed in 500 years. The only Black history we ever discuss is 500 years, right? Which is a crazy thing to think that every other history in the world gets discussed in 6,000, 4,000, 8,000
years. Okay, I see what you mean, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so if you look at Black history in 500 years, it's fucking horrendous, right? But if you look at it in 2,000 years, it's not that bad. Do you know what I mean? When you start looking at history then in 5,000 years, you start realizing that everybody has had a shit time in history.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And when you start realizing that everyone has had a shit time in history, you therefore start realizing that Black people are the only people in the history of mankind to sort out their situation in 500 years.
Okay. That's a good angle.
No, but it's not even an angle. It's the truth.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And so then if you start looking at history like that,
uh-huh,
you therefore start appreciating yourself more. Because I don't know when you watch my show, but the my shows at the moment are a lot about self-identity. And this idea that your identity has been described a particular way, like in the show now, I have this bit about where in school, all I was ever taught about myself is that I was a hunter-gatherer. That's it, you know? And I'm just like, oh shit, this is weird. Because what does that do to me as a 30-year-old person? Does that give me confidence, like now? You know what I mean? Because all you ever know about yourself is that you're a slave or a hunter-gatherer. And you're like, yeah, but what was I doing 2,000 years ago? That's more, you know what I mean? Don't talk to me about me 500 years. Talk to me about what I was doing 2,000. Then when you start talking about Black history in 2,000 years, you therefore then start realizing Timbuktu, fucking start talking about the pyramids. Which are weird things, because what happens with the pyramids is that people refuse that the Egyptians built the fucking pyramids. Like, oh, these aliens. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? So you're telling me these aliens came from wherever the fuck they came from, built these things, and then drew the people from there? No, you know what I mean? So these are like weird issues that I want to talk about on stand-up, but they're so like intense and...
That's quite like it's a big sweep of information that you need to get them on board with.
Right. But then the way people consume things sometimes, it's not like the way people see history is in the way they consume history is we have to be on the same page for me to do that joke. I find it weird trying to get people to learn things in stand-up. Because for stand-up to work properly, we almost have to be on the same page.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so we have a same default. And so when you introducing ideas to people, not necessarily like funny ideas, life ideas to people, it becomes an extremely complicated thing. Because people are like, fucking hell, that was true and heavy and da-da-da-da. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because that feeling interrupts the laugh.
It totally interrupts the laugh. And so sometimes I'm like, yo, you got to be heavy and edgy. And you're like, nah, it fucking confuses the shit out of people. Think of like if I did this bit of now on stage, or even how do I place this bit on stage? Right? How do I do it? So this is what I try to do. I try to get to that stage where I can turn this bit of material that is... it's complicated and make it a bit that's accessible to anyone.
Yeah.
Like an 18-year-old recently graduated high school student can go, oh shit, I get that.
Yes.
And that's the hardest thing with stand-up. So I try to always push myself. Before, I used to do very observational stuff, which I still do, but I, of late, I've been really, and maybe also because I spend a lot of time in Britain, really talking about myself way more.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
Which is something that I've picked up in Britain.
So what would you say of the show that you're doing here at The Fringe this year? Which, because there's some really good observational stuff in there. There's, you know, Wi-Fi, airports, and you know what I mean? There's like really good kind of, I think of it as like nuts and bolts stand-up.
Right.
And I don't mean it's boring. Like, there we go. Bang. That works. We're with you. This, you can imagine that working. 2,000 people. We all get it.
Right.
So what for you is the kind of the trickier stuff in this current hour that you're doing that is the more personal stuff?
I think when I talk about growing up, and the funny thing is, when I talk about growing up, it's cool because I talk about growing up during apartheid, and I kind of, and that subject kind of makes people lean back a little bit.
Absolutely.
And I do acknowledge that British people get really uncomfortable when you talk about race and colonialism and da 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 da. And so what I do is, I have jokes about their reactions to it now.
Yes.
Right? And so everything that makes you uncomfortable, I have a joke about why it makes you uncomfortable. So I've tapped into their subconscious. And so when they go, I'm going to burn this bit. Anyway, so I go, I don't know if you saw me doing this. I talk about the begging dude. Mm-hmm. And where he's like, he doesn't want to, he'd rather be in London begging than be in Africa. And everyone is uncomfortable about that. Then I'm like, yeah, but that's the honest truth amongst everyone in this room. Would you rather be me in fucking Rwanda? No, you don't want to be there. You'd rather be here. No matter how bad you have it here, you're like, fuck that, I'm not going there. That's one. Then I go, you're uncomfortable about that because you think your pound a day, because you saw an advert that says a pound a day you can feed an African.
Yeah, yeah.
You fucking can't. You can't feed an African a day. You know what I mean? And then it gets a biggish laugh. And then I go, if you really want to help Africa, cancel the debt and give us back our gold. And then it just goes, whoo. And then you go, you didn't allow them to dwell in their uncomfortable space.
Yes.
Right. You dragged them out of it. You really did. And you scrutinize why they were uncomfortable, and you kind of, come on then. And then it works because comedy is tapping into the subconscious and there's a great deal of resonance that happens. So when you go to the audience, you are not helping. He's like, yeah, well, fuck, I'm really not fucking helping. And so you really drag them out of their comfort zone, which I find fun.
So with the political content of your act, with the more political, with the satire, do you find, and I say this, I'm not at all a political comedian. I feel like one of the reasons that I'm not a political comedian is I don't know how to fix things. So I feel like if you're going to be, and this is a preconception, I'm probably wrong, but I feel like as a political comedian, it would be my duty to suggest something better than what we have. When you're doing your political kind of stuff, do you feel any responsibility like that? Can you simply attack the existing system, or do you feel like you need to present alternatives?
Not entirely. No. You can be upset about something and not have an alternative. You could just be like, this is fucked up. And you might not have an alternative, but you'd be like, but this here is not working. I wouldn't want to be involved in politics in that way. I think what I do is speaking about the issues and making people get out of their comfort zone when I talk about these issues. I think for me, it could be enough. Personally, I don't feel I should go beyond that.
And with the show, when you do late night news,
right?
Do you feel, well, how does that fit into that kind of answer? Do you feel like, because that is explicitly a satirical show, if you look at something like what John Oliver is doing,
right,
in the States at the moment,
right,
where he's kind of going, this, he's really zeroing in,
right,
on this is an issue, this is why it's a problem, and then I don't know that he'll posit a genuine solution, but he might posit a comic solution.
Right. Yeah, but I don't. No, I still don't. I mean, also, I'm just trying to think. I don't know what the policemen in America should do going forward, because I don't know, right? But I do know they should stop shooting unarmed black people. That's what I fucking, I don't need to, you know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't think that, yeah, if you look at, I don't know if you are aware of Fela Kuti. Fela Kuti was a huge Nigerian act, and he got involved in politics. Shit went pear-shaped.
I don't know that. What can you film?
He
me
was
on
a
that?
Huge act. He was.
I've definitely heard the name, but I don't know.
A Nigerian act, and he started Movement of the People, political movement, and he was a very political musician, very politically active, and you know. They killed his mom. And so that's quite intense, you know, and it is intense, but politicians, they know the political landscape and they navigate that accordingly. And as an artist, you're getting your mom killed is hyperbole, right? It's quite an intense thing. But what I'm trying to indicate is that you're an act and an artist, and you have this platform, and this platform you choose to use it a particular way, and that's fine, and that could just be your role in this whole thing, and that could serve as a catalyst to a bigger debate, and also it serves as normalizing the discussion or the issue, right, and making it okay, let's talk about, we're talking about this now, is that part of the national dialogue? Yeah. And that for me could be enough. And also, you must remember, there are people who are devoted to whatever cause it is, and they're active towards that cause. And if you're speaking about this on stage, you are helping them out as well by enlightening people a little bit and making them laugh and making them aware of the issue. You don't necessarily yourself have to be involved in the hands-onness of the thing. You know what I mean? It's like if a footballer is having a football game and is wearing a t-shirt that he scores a goal, lifts up his t-shirt and says, I don't know, he says, free Palestine, whatever the case is, right? He's making his political statement. And 20 million people in the world are like, okay, cool. That's right. But there are people actively fighting that cause. That act of lifting that t-shirt could mobilize people to rally towards that cause.
That's a really good answer. Thank you. One of the reviews that I read of your... I'll do my research.
I've had some shitty reviews.
No. This is not a negative review. Someone said, I don't know, I can't attest to whether this is true, politicians treat him like a rock star.
Back home, yeah. I think they liked me because I was fair, right? I was really fair. Like, I would dissect the issue. So I wouldn't go at them per se. I would make fun of them relative to the issue at hand. So whereas a lot of people would dig up dirt. First of all, what we didn't do, we didn't dig up dirt on the person. We only reacted on the news. So we would invite these guys and we would roast them and dissect them. But at the end of the day, I think they always felt that we were fair. And we didn't, and also we've never really aligned ourselves with any political movement, or we've never left or right. We were just always like, these guys are the, and so our commentary never felt one-sided. So every time I would bump into one of these politicians at the airport, they would really be excited. I'm like, hey man, why are you having me over to make fun of me? I'm like, dude. So yeah, they really did. That's actually true. If I walked into Parliament, I'd be a proper rock star.
They'd be like, no one has ever said that sentence on this podcast.
I don't think anyone has ever said that sentence, period.
So when you, and I believe it was in the same thing, it was an interesting sentence. He won't say it, but he wants to make it overseas.
I do. I mean, yeah, I do.
So talk to me about the positioning when you release your Vimeo special. What thought are you or your management putting into the branding of Lawyer Sugola? Who are you trying to say, this is me, this is who I am? Where do you want to be? Where do you want to get to?
Oh, man. I haven't really overthought that. I think that at the moment, I'm just doing the best stand-up possible, right? So at the moment, the idea is for everyone who sees me perform, they gotta go, that act is good, or that act is funny, or any reviewer, that, they have to go, I want to see that guy again, right? So if I can leave that impression with the people that I perform to, that for me would lead to the next thing. I don't want to think about the next thing too much, because the next thing, I believe in this, this could sound pretentious, but I believe in the synchronicity of life, right? So I believe a lot of people might attribute it to the Bible and the Quran and just the idea that everything happens for a reason. I genuinely believe it does. I believe there's this, we're spinning on this earth and we're spinning at a very fast pace and we're living on, and everyone is so calm about it. But you, if you just wake people up and be like, you know what's actually fucking going on? We're spinning in the universe, you know what I mean? And so at such a fast speed as well, but you don't feel it. But we are actually spinning. But, and in this spinning of ours, there's all these things that are happening, right? And some, and so what needs to happen is that you need to see the things that are happening, right? So if I said to you, while we're doing a podcast, a bird just flew across this room, what would you say?
How do you mean? If one did it now?
Yeah. If I said to you, we're doing, and I say, a bird just flew across, what would you say?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. One did fly across, or you're telling me that one flew across?
Okay, I'm telling you a bird just flew across. What would you say? What do you say for the, to that?
Sweet. That sounds good. I love birds.
But did you see the bird?
No.
So the bird didn't fly?
I understand what you mean.
Right? Okay. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. So what I'm saying is, just because you didn't see the bird, doesn't mean didn't happen.
I thought you meant through the room.
Yeah. No. Okay. Just because you didn't see the bird fly through the room, doesn't mean the bird didn't fly through the room.
Okay.
So what I try to do with my life is try to see the bird fly through the room all the time. And so there's a synchronicity that happens constantly, right? You meeting me, see me at Top Secret, and to you, it might be random acts of, but to me, it's a total synchronicity. It's like it's happening for a reason.
Okay.
And that reason could be between me and the universe. But at any given second, there's something special happening, and you might not be able to tangibly like touch it at the time. But I've had like strange coincidences happen. I'm like, this is not a fucking coincidence. This is the universe conspiring to give me everything I've ever wanted. And so I truly believe that shit is happening constantly. And so what needs to happen is that you need to see it.
Does that, I mean, that is probably the most optimistic thing anyone has ever said on this show. Do you need to make an effort to feel that? When you say, I truly believe, does that just mean like, well, your life is incredible. You're happy all the time.
I'm appreciative all the time. I'm not happy all the time. I'm appreciative all the time. But I do, it's got to do with actually being in the moment and acknowledging the moment. And this moment means this particular thing. So this podcast, like, I'll tell you one thing. How long have we been doing this podcast?
An hour.
I've thought of nothing else except this podcast. I'm in the moment of the podcast.
Okay.
I'm enjoying the podcast. I'm enjoying this thing. And because it's happening, it's the only thing that's important to me right now. Right. I have to go to a BBC, recording in 45 minutes. It takes me about 20 minutes to get home. I'm not worried at all. because I've switched off my phone. The last text is it. So I'm like, I need to be here to totally enjoy this and totally operate at my optimum and enjoy this entire moment. And that's what's happened. Right. And it's the way I try to live my life. It's a very difficult thing to exercise.
Is it self-taught, or did someone put you onto this? Is this like from a book or a...
No. It's self-taught. Someone mentioned it to me, and I did think this is definitely the best way to live life. It's totally the best. Like, there's certain things that and you're like, yeah, okay, that's cool. I believe meeting you is a good thing, And that could lead to something that's way amazing in the future. You don't know it yet. And it's happening. I'm in this matrix but I'm fully aware of everything and I'm taking in everything. And I know comics are quite like cynical. They're cynical fuckers, man. Comics are just cynics. And I'm just, and I try to, impart this idea of like, fuck, you live a great life. No, fuck it. And you're like, nah, you're good. You should be way happier than you actually are.
Are you happy?
I am. I'd like to think I am. I'd like to really think I am happy. I would tick all the boxes in terms of if you were to define it. I'd be like, yeah, I'm quite happy.
I think that's all.
That's it.
What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
He's enjoying this moment.
So that was Loyasu. Thank you very much to him for coming along. Keep your eyes peeled. Get on his Twitter and his website and find out exactly how that went down with the show, the special that he was going off to record. Didn't he sound confident about it? Isn't that idea of just thinking to yourself, yes, everything is great. It's all supposed to be like this and it's all good. Wouldn't it be great to feel like that? God, would it? Yeah, I mean, obviously he sort of enjoys it, but can you really believe that deep down? Like, I often think it would be great to be religious. I'm not religious, but obviously, if you believed in a God, then surely you just have a better life. You're secure and confident, and you know you're going to go to an afterlife or a heaven. And there's all sorts of fringe benefits to do with, you know, group. I'm trying not to say fringe benefits to do with tambourines, because that seems, you know, derisory, and I don't mean it like that. But, you know, you get to believe in stuff and hang out with other people who believe the same thing as you. It must be like being a football supporter. I can only imagine. I can only dream. But that was the man, and thank you very much to him for coming along. Thank you to Daryl for uploading the show and editing it. Thanks to everyone that's been supporting the show recently. I realise the amount of people who are doing recurring payments. They trickle in £1 here, £2 there, £5 there. And I had a bit of a count of them recently and saw how many people are doing that. And it really, since I started asking for donations on the show a couple of years ago, the one-off donations are very kind. And if you'd like to make one, you can, of course, do that at comedianscomedian.com with whatever you think is appropriate. I mean, God, we're nearly at 200 shows now. So if you want to hit £1 a show, I'd get in quick before it breaks the bank. Some people do that, and thank you very much to them. When I started asking for recurring donations much less recently, there's a few of you that do it. People do it on patreon.com as well, patreon.com/comcompod, and they're tiny little amounts, and I have to say that most of these things are geared towards people pay a little thing and then they get a special thing. And you know, the way I do it with this show is everybody gets the thing for free, which is the podcast. And if you want to pay to say thanks, you can do that. You don't get anything extra for paying. I'm just relying on it for goodwill. I just think that some people want to be able to support the show, and so they can. So what I mean to say is I suddenly counted them all the other night and I went, oh, that's quite a few. Thanks. If you're one of the people out there who's paying £1 or two or even more per month, then thank you so much. What will happen now, of course, is that people will listen to this who'd forgotten their payments will go, oh, God, I meant to cancel that. And then they'll pull out. And if that's you, then thanks for all the time. Thanks for the money. I appreciate it. But hopefully more people will support the show than decide to stop doing so. That was the world's worst busker. Oh my God. Anyway, that's all of that. Thank you for supporting the show. And remember, if you don't want to or can't do that financially, instead you can simply share it with a friend and get more people listening to ComComPod. That can only be a good thing. So do join the Facebook group. Look out for some sort of Facebook live event in the near future where I ask you guys what you think of the show and any sort of suggestions you have. We're rejudging the music. That's pretty exciting. Yes. Maybe I'll make sure I do the live thing before we rejudge the music so that it doesn't just become a big thing either, complaining about the old or indeed the new music. That's us for now. Thanks, Daryl. Thank you to Emily Crosby, who logged this episode for me and has done much more than that besides. And thanks to you for listening. I always say that at the end of a sentence. And thanks to you. Cringeworthy. I just can't help myself. I'll chat to you in a bit if you'd like to hang around. But for now, that concludes the podcast. So what will I talk to you about now? Hey, why don't I get in a... I've got in a bit of a groove. Here's... I told you, didn't I? I told you last week about the dread and about kind of not looking forward to... Of course I'm looking forward to doing interviews with people, but that often is masked behind this sort of miasma of, oh, God, what if I do it badly or wrong? So we talked about that a little bit. I don't know if I want to go back into that. I've got some belting questions for Minchin. Tim Minchin is... I mean, by now, when this goes out, I'll have done him. But I've got some. I think he's such a literate kind of a guy. And then Maria Bamford is just. It's going to be very hard not to just be in awe of Maria Bamford. Those of you who asked about who I asked on the ComCom Facebook group to you know give me your questions. So many of you just said, "Can you just tell her I love her?" It's brilliant. How lovely to inspire that sort of thing. So I tell you what I've done today is I took the Boutros to Baby Sensory. I don't think I've mentioned that to you before. I've only been twice. This is my second trip. You take a bunch of parents, predominantly women, but there was one other dad there. It was quite nice to see another dad. We looked at each other in that sheepish dadding kind of way. And, oh, God, I'll tell you. All right. I'll tell you about dad blanking in a second. But anyway, Baby Sensory is you get the babies in a room and there's like a soft thing in front of them. And they have a theme like the rainforest. They throw some furry spiders out. The babies play with the furry spiders. They play with a leaf. You do sign language based songs, which are really fun and incredibly hooky and earwormy. And today the theme was France. And I just thought, what a great, we're going to give the baby a sensory experience. We're going to pretend they're in France. How odd is that? You know, when you like, you know, the weirdness, the very slight weirdness of being in a foreign country. Like, I always remember stepping off the plane in Australia for the first time and going, God, the air smells different here. That slight, or the weirdness of going round a different person's house, being in someone else's kitchen when you're a kid and going, oh, it's the same, but it's all sort of different. There's something similar, isn't there, about, I love the idea that a baby sensory experience would be, we're going to put the babies in France, which is sort of a lot like here, but subtly different. And then just seeing if all these little babies could pick up on it and go, oh yes, I do feel, I mean, I can do nothing now to make this funny apart from loads of cliches. The one I was thinking was, the babies are like, yes, I'm going to have an affair. Isn't that awful? That's my go-to as a sort of a French stereotype. Oh, dear. Anyway, dad blanking. I mentioned this on Facebook and there was outrage, so I'll just share this with you quickly before I leave you to zip off and play with the boy before nicking off to LA tomorrow in real time as opposed to the time at which you're listening to this. This happened when I was in the Edinburgh Festival and I had this weekend of looking after the Boutros on my own because my partner flew down to London to go to a friend's wedding. And I had this very enjoyable kind of baptism of fire experience looking after the baby just on my own. You know, supported friends and so forth were there, but really kind of like, right, he's normally on the boob and now it's just milk. And if he doesn't want milk out of a bottle, he's not eating. So let's try and make that work. Very exciting, very empowering. I would really recommend it to any dad. It really made me feel much more like, oh yeah, you need that kind of, you need to cross the Rubicon, don't you? You need to go, right, she isn't here, and I've got to cope for 48 hours, or in my case, I think it was more like sort of 40, but a great experience. On one of the mornings, the first morning I went out with him, I saw another dad, and I dad blanked him. Look, when dads see other dads, when we're walking around with babies, we have to give each other a sheepish kind of we've got to raise the eyebrows, we've got to do that thing. I was really annoyed about this. I was writing some stand-up about that thing that people do when, you know what you do with your mouth when you see someone and you don't quite say hi, you just kind of go, I mean, I can mime it now. Does it make a noise? It sounds like this. You know, it's that. And then I saw a really good sketch on it. I think it was on Key and Peele. And I was like, nope, damn it, that's been done. Drop that, fine. But you're supposed to at least do that when you see a dad. And I saw this dad and he looked confident. He looked tougher than me. He's probably a Scottish dad. He looked vigorous. He looked like, you know, a jiu-jitsu kind of a dad. Like I'm a, you know, sort of like he was a sort of physically confident blokey sort of a dad. And I'm there at the Edinburgh Festival in my yellow top and my skinny jeans and my golden trainers, feeling like an absolute, you know, feeling like a tit by comparison. So I saw him and he looked happy enough. And so I didn't raise my eyebrows or say hi. And then I walked away feeling awful. But it's not like he looked to me for anything. I just thought, that guy's sorted. Come on. Grow up, Stu. Not every dad is automatically your friend. There's no need to make eye contact with that guy. And then, so, I don't remember exactly what happened. I think we made eye contact. And I looked away. And almost like, as I looked away, I could feel him nod in my peripheral vision. But by then I'd looked away, so I kept walking. And then I felt terrible about it. I put it on Facebook. I just blanked a dad. And these are all the dads of young children I know on Facebook, like, you are disgusting. That was priceless. And then the next day, of course, what happened? I saw a different dad. I nodded at him. I got dad blanked. Instant karma. That'll do for now. I got to run. I got to go and pack for LA. How sweet a sentence is that? And I tell you what, I can't wait to go. But having designed my life assiduously, does that mean sort of deliberately and with detail, maybe? Having designed my life so that a 20-year-old version of me can have a brilliant, independent, exciting time with loads of travel and fun gigs. 33 for showbiz purposes. 39-year-old Stu is properly going. Well done, smarty pants. You know, great, exciting, adventurous life you've got. All I really want to do is stay here and rub my face on my baby's tummy. Anyway, that's him entering the room now. He doesn't realise this is the Boutros entering. I've been recording in his room because it is quite a well soundproof room. He's looking at me now. Before this gets too cute, I'm going to go. Lots of love. Boutros, would you like to say anything to the podcast people? Thanks, mate. Bye from us.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.